From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The film Road to Perdition is based on a graphic novel written by Max Allan Collins. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Collins. He twice won the Seamus Award from the Private Eye Writers of America for his Nathaniel Heller historical thrillers. For several years, he wrote the Dick Tracy comic strip. Later, we'll talk with the director of the film Road to Perdition, Sam Mendes. He won an Academy Award for directing American Beauty. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the word legend has edged out the word hero and what it says about us and the power of the media. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Two teenage girls abducted early this morning in the high desert north of Los Angeles have been rescued, and the suspect in their abduction has been shot and killed. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
16-year-old Tamara Brooks and 17-year-old Jacqueline Maris were sitting in separate cars with male friends about 1 o'clock this morning in an area outside the town of Lancaster known as a Lover's Lane. They were taken at gunpoint by a man who has now tentatively been identified as Roy Ratliff. He was wanted on an unrelated rape warrant. Their boyfriends were tied up and left unharmed. The kidnapping sparked an intense manhunt across the Southwest. Sheriff's deputies in Kern County, north of Los Angeles, found the girls this afternoon and shot and killed Ratliff. Los Angeles Assistant Sheriff Larry Waldy credited a new alert system that notifies authorities around the state when a major crime has been committed, especially one involving a child, and even puts messages on freeway signs to involve the public in the search. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Two former top executives at WorldCom surrendered to authorities in New York City today. WorldCom's former chief financial officer, Scott Sullivan, and the former controller, David Myers, faced a 7-count indictment in federal court. They're accused of securities fraud and other charges, alleging that they conspired to conceal $3.8 billion in expenses at the bankrupt telecom. A lawyer for Sullivan called the arrests a rush to judgment and said the case was politically motivated. Attorney General John Ashcroft held a news conference to say that arrests, indictments, and prosecutions send the message that corrupt corporate executives are no better than common thieves. The two men were released on bond after they were charged. Congress has given President Bush a legislative victory he's been pressing for since taking office, wider power to negotiate trade deals. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
With trade promotion authority, the president can negotiate trade agreements, which can then be approved or rejected by Congress, but which can't be modified in any way. The bill narrowly passed the House last weekend. Now the Senate has approved it in a 64-34 vote. In a conference call, the president thanked Senate leaders from both parties.
Some farmer's going to be able to sell his product, and some nation's going to be able to trade with us, which will help lift them out of poverty. I want to congratulate you very much for your fine work.
Trade Promotion Authority, once known as Fast Track, lapsed in 1994. Passage this time hinged on the inclusion of aid for workers who lose their jobs because of foreign trade. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 230 points or 2.6% to close at 8,506 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 48 points, that's 3.6%, to close at 1,280. The S&P 500 lost 27 or nearly 3%. This is NPR News. President Bush said today that he's furious over yesterday's bombing at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. 5 of the 7 people killed in that bombing were Americans. Speaking at a photo session with Jordan's King Abdullah, the president said that despite his anger, he still believes that peace in the Middle East is possible. In Colorado, firefighters are reporting initial success against a fast-moving wildfire near Aspen. Elsewhere, other fires are burning out of control. Eric Whitney reports from Telluride, Colorado.
The fire approximately 20 miles northwest of Aspen started Wednesday and grew quickly to 2,000 acres, destroying 2 homes and burning 2 others. Firefighters attacked it aggressively and are now calling it 70% contained. Milder than expected weather has proven helpful. About 200 homes in the area remain evacuated at this time. The cause of the fire is unknown, but investigators are suspicious that it was human-caused. In the far southwestern corner of Colorado, crews continue to struggle with a 3,300-acre fire that has closed Mesa Verde National Park. That lightning-sparked fire is being called only 5% contained, despite continuing air attack on the blaze since it began Monday. Three other fires continue to burn out of control in northwestern Colorado and have so far consumed more than 8,000 acres, but in largely uninhabited areas. For NPR News, I'm Eric Whitney in Telluride, Colorado.
Activity at the nation's factories slowed in July, raising concerns about the strength of the economic recovery. The Institute for Supply Management said its economic index fell more than 5 points to 50.5. A reading above 50 indicates that the economy is still expanding, but at a very slow pace. The sharp drop surprised many analysts who'd been expecting just a slight decline. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A little later, we'll meet Sam Mendes, the director of the new film Road to Perdition. First, we talk with Max Allan Collins, who wrote the graphic novel Road to Perdition, which the movie is based on. Road to Perdition is set during the Depression and is the story of two fathers who are each protecting a son. One father, played in the movie by Paul Newman, is the head of the Irish mob in Rock Island, Illinois. His son is out of control and gun crazy. The other father, played by Tom Hanks, works as the head mobster's chief hitman. The hitman's son witnesses the mobster's son kill someone. The mobster's son wants to kill the hitman's son so that he can't squeal. So the hitman has to protect his son by trying to kill the mobster's son. The hitman seeks the help of the Italian mob in Chicago. When they refuse to cooperate, he steals their money from the bank. Here's Tom Hanks as the hitman robbing a bank.
Well, this is a pleasant surprise. I wasn't expecting another deposit until the end of the month.
Actually, I'm making a withdrawal. I want dirty money only. Everything you're holding for Capone, that's off the books. Open the safe.
You're insane. You know they'll find out who you are.
The name's Sullivan. You want me to spell it? Open the box.
They'll kill you. They're animals.
You don't say.
The scene we just heard was taken right out of the graphic novel Road to Perdition, written by my guest Max Allan Collins. A graphic novel is a book-length story illustrated like a comic book. Collins is a longtime detective writer whose books include a series of historical mysteries featuring the fictional detective Nathan Heller. Collins wrote the Dick Tracy comic strip for several years after its creator retired. He told me the character of the Irish mobster in Road to Perdition is based on a real mobster.
I took the story of this Irish crime godfather in Rock Island, Illinois, in the 1920s, a guy named John Looney. And I guess that's my comic book background, that name Looney was irresistible to me. And he had a Looney son named Connor who was a homicidal maniac. So you sort of had this wonderful... you've got, it's like the good Caesar and the bad Caesar. You know, the guy coming up is a lunatic, basically, and yet the father, of course, loves him. And this all really happened in Rock Island, Illinois, in the early part of the 20th century. I thought it would make a good sort of underpinning of history for this tale.
And then you created a fictional character to go along with this real-life father and son team. The fictional character is the character played by Tom Hanks in the movie Road to Perdition. In your novel, he's called the Archangel of Death. Tell us about this character and how you created him.
Well, in real life, there were a couple of lieutenants of John Looney, this godfather, who Looney betrayed. And I thought that would be kind of a good... historical hole I could plug a fictional character into. And I had been thinking for a long time about trying to do sort of an American samurai story. I was, in the early 90s, really caught up in a lot of Asian pop culture, particularly the movies of John Woo. Now, John Woo has since become a major director here in America. But in the late 80s, early 90s, he was this cult figure, and collectors were just sort of passing around VHS tapes. And he was doing these sort of wild action scenes, guys sliding down banisters with guns in both hands, blazing. And at the same time, I was watching Kurosawa and other Japanese and Chinese directors who were dealing with samurais and various kinds of larger-than-life swordsmen. And I thought that would be an interesting concept to transpose into American pop culture and American history. It occurred to me that a samurai was somewhat like a gangster, and that the shogun was somewhat like the godfather. And so that was the thought of taking this character Michael O'Sullivan and having him be sort of the American shogun's samurai, and have him be betrayed by his shogun.
How did the movie adaptation get made of your graphic novel?
Well, the graphic novel was published in 1998, and I must say, to no particular fanfare, the graphic novel as a form is something of a niche. In fact, comics themselves are not as mainstream as I would like them to be in this country, and so really a fairly small audience, probably about 5,000 people, read that novel when it came out. So to me, it was just sort of another of many projects I was involved in, and I kind of went about my business with various things I was working on, independent films and novels and so on. But my agent saw some real possibilities in this graphic novel, and he sent it out to a Hollywood agent. And this agent looked at the material and, again, really responded well to it. And he sent it to a guy named Dean Zanuck. Now, of course, that's a very famous last name. And Dean, the son of Richard Zanuck, who's the son of Daryl Zanuck, legendary Hollywood moguls, Dean Zanuck responded very positively to this material. And he sent it to his dad, Richard, who happened to be, I think, in Morocco on some other picture. And he called his dad and said, "This is being FedExed to you." His father said, as a lot of people have lately, "What's a graphic novel?" And Dean said, "Well, don't worry about it. Just take a look at it." And Richard Zanuck read it, responded very favorably to it. He FedExed it back to Hollywood to Steven Spielberg. And Spielberg loved it, apparently said, "Great, I don't even have to storyboard it." And then Steven Spielberg sent it to Tom Hanks. Hanks responded very well to it. Anyway, all of this happened in about 5 days, which is pretty remarkable in terms of Hollywood. So this fairly obscure graphic novel suddenly, in a matter of less than a week, climbs to the top of the Hollywood food chain. Meanwhile, I'm back in Iowa just sort of tending the crops, so to speak.
Well, I'm sure that the release of the film Road to Perdition has caused you to think a lot about the differences between novels, graphic novels, and movies. So let's talk a little bit about the way you tell the story in the graphic novel Road to Perdition. You know, in some ways, it's very stripped down because there's just a few lines of dialogue per page with several illustrations per page. But it's still a very rich story. Do you have a different style of storytelling in a graphic novel than you do in an actual novel?
I've always viewed myself as a storyteller, and I think one of the problems that a lot of novelists have in terms of trying to take their work into film, let's say, is that they don't have a grasp of the difference between these mediums. Probably the fact that I have worked in comics as many years as I have, which is sort of a medium, if you think about it, that is perched in between comics and, sort of straight prose novels. That may give me a little bit better avenue into either of these forms. Because in terms of comics, you obviously are dealing with visuals. And if you were to look at one of my scripts for for any comic book or for a graphic novel like Road to Perdition, you would see that 80% of what I write really is directions to the artist, telling the artist what to draw. And, a very small percentage of what I write will be the actual copy, the actual dialogue or captions or narration. So I have to think visually. I have to think in terms, I have to actually, at least in a preliminary sense, design the page. And that gets me thinking in pictures and telling the story in pictures. And this has been very helpful to me as I've moved into writing screenplays and doing independent films. Because there's very basic differences here. If you take the film and the novel, for example, a film really is the exterior of a story. I mean, you're sitting as a viewer watching the story play out. But when you read a novel, you're inside the story. It's the interior of the story. And you tend to experience novels usually through one character at a time, inside that character's perceptions. And, you know, so if you have, as a storyteller, if you really don't understand these differences in point of view, you're going to go down the wrong road.
Max Allen Collins is my guest. He's a mystery writer, and he did the graphic novel Road to Perdition, on which the new movie is based. The filmmakers made several plot changes and character changes in the adaptation from your graphic novel. How did you feel about the differences in story in the movie versus in your book?
The screenwriter, David Self, I think, did a terrific job. Again, perhaps because I'm in a modest way a filmmaker myself, having done three independent films and written quite a few screenplays, I don't have that protective sort of tunnel vision view of my own work when it comes to adapting it. I know that you have to look at a source work and reorganize it and rethink it and sometimes even reinvent it. I think one of the smartest things that Self did was take all of these hitmen that I had pursuing the father and son, and every now and then they would have a kind of a confrontation, a shootout or whatever. They rolled all of these hitmen characters up into this one character played by Jude Law, the reporter, who's basically the only character in the movie that I didn't create. But I might have created him. He's very much the kind of character that appears in my stories. I felt very comfortable with that. I felt extremely comfortable with the decision to emphasize the father and son relationship between Paul Newman's character and Tom Hanks's character. That was in the graphic novel. It was sort of understood and implied that there was a father and son relationship and that Looney preferred O'Sullivan to his own sort of incompetent son. But they did it in such a dramatic and cinematic fashion that, if anything, they improved on me. And I'm always willing to be improved upon.
Now, the truly bizarre thing about your position is that you wrote the graphic novel Road to Perdition. The movie Road to Perdition was adapted from your graphic novel. Then you wrote the novelization of the movie. So you have two different versions of Road to Perdition. You've got the original version, and then you've got the novel version that's based on the movie adaptation of your original work. How did you end up writing the novelization, and how peculiar did that feel?
It was very peculiar. I think you may know that I'm one of the things I've done over the last 10 or 15 years, actually since I lost the Dick Tracy strip, was take on a lot of novelizations for Hollywood studios. I've arguably am the top or one of the top movie novel guys. And it's a very peculiar kind of job you take, because what happens is you have something like, say, Saving Private Ryan, where they know it's going to be a big picture, it's going to be an important movie, but it's an original screenplay, so they'd like to have a novel. So I am commissioned by someone like DreamWorks to develop a novel out of the screenplay, not out of the movie, because the movie usually hasn't been shot yet or is being shot while I'm writing the novel. So it's a little tricky. I will take the screenplay and develop the novel from that. And I've had a lot of luck with that. I've done like the Mummy and The Mummy Returns and In the Line of Fire and Air Force One. In fact, a book I did recently called Wind Talkers, ironically from a John Woo movie, mm-hmm. has done extremely well. So I knew, because the original story of Road to Perdition was a graphic novel, that there probably would be a novelization done. So I thought, if someone's going to do it, why shouldn't I do it? I mean, I better do it. So I also felt, and I was wrong about this, I have to tell you, I was flat out wrong, but I also felt that when the original graphic novel was reprinted, it would remain a kind of a niche book. I really didn't think that mainstream readers would be able to cross that line in into comics and read a sort of serious adult story in comics form. And for that reason, I felt there ought to be a straight novel, a prose novel version out there. And if there was going to be one, obviously I wanted to do it myself. Now, where I was wrong is, right now, the graphic novel is outselling the novelization, even though I wrote it. We got onto the extended New York Times bestseller list with the graphic novel. It may be the first graphic novel ever to get on the New York Times list. I'm not sure, but it's a rarity nonetheless.
My guest is Max Allen Collins. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Max Allen Collins. He's a detective writer. He's written a lot of comic books. He used to do the Dick Tracy series. He wrote the graphic novel Road to Perdition. That's the novel that the movie is based on. And then he wrote the novelization of the movie after the movie screenplay was written. So, I'm wondering if when you write novelizations of movies like Saving Private Ryan and Air Force One, In the Line of Fire, if you ever take slightly confusing or ambiguous plot lines and just kind of like straighten them out in the novel, you know how sometimes you leave a movie and you say, I don't understand. In that scene, like, what really happened? Why did somebody really do something?
You know, that's a lot of what I do in writing novelizations. Part of it is to create background and backstory for characters. But a lot of what I do is fix them. I plug the plot holes. And I get that a lot from my readers who say, well, now I understand the movie, and they don't realize that I just sort of came in after the fact with my, you know, my spackle and mortar and fixed it up.
Don't take this the wrong way, but who would want to read a novelization after seeing the movie? Because the movie is the original work. It's the kind of definitive story. And the novelization is just kind of based on the movie.
Well, there's two answers to that. The glib one is a confused audience that doesn't understand that the book didn't actually come first. So I depend on the ignorance of the readers, which is an awful thing, but there's a certain amount of that. People just don't understand the process, and they assume the book came first. The better answer, I think, the answer that makes it valid for me to be doing this, is that the difference between the mediums gives you an opportunity to see that story in a different way. As I said earlier, the movie's the exterior version of the story, and a novel is the interior version. So I can give you what the characters are thinking. I can tell you who they are and where they grew up and what they're thinking. You know, I can give it to you in the way only a novelist can.
But do you ever feel funny because it's not your original story? You're rewriting somebody else's story. You're reinventing their characters. We accept that in a movie more than we accept that in a novel.
Well, the funny thing about that is that because I haven't seen the movie and I'm working from a screenplay, a strange proprietary thing happens to me. It makes me think I did write it, so that when I actually go to see the movie, say 6 months later, I think I'm seeing a movie based on a book I wrote. I know I'm not, and it's stupid, but that's the sensation I have. Also, a couple of times I've had movies where they've actually taken stuff from my novelizations and put them into the movies, because when the novelization went to be approved by the director or whatever, they may have seen how I fixed something, or they may notice some dialogue that's better than what they have. And in at least one instance, they actually reshot a scene and based it on a scene I wrote in the novelization.
Max Allen Collins is my guest. He wrote the graphic novel Road to Perdition, on which the movie is based. He's also a detective novelist who's written many detective novels. One of your series is about the detective Nate Heller, and this is a kind of historical detective. Most of the stories are set in the 30s and 40s, or is it 20s and 30s?
It's mostly the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. The new one, Chicago Confidential, is set in 1950 and is the first one that will take us, I hope, into the 50s and later the 60s.
And this series combines real life and fictional characters. So Al Capone, Bugsy Siegel are in at the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, Amelia Earhart, the Lindbergh kidnapping. Why combine historical and fictional elements in this series?
Well, what happened was I had wanted to write a Private Eye series since I was a kid. I loved Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and Mickey Spillane, and yet I didn't think that Private Eye worked very well in contemporary times. I thought he worked best, you know, in a fedora and a trench coat and in that period where he was created by those writers. And it occurred to me one day that the Private Eye had been around long enough to exist in an historical context so that I sort of realized that Sam Spade and Al Capone were contemporaries. So I could actually put a Sam Spade kind of character into a story with not an Al Capone type, but actually Al Capone. And then the next step was to think, well, if I'm going to do that, why not do real crimes? You know, the Private Eye's got to solve a mystery. Let him solve, you know, who killed Huey Long, or let him find out what happened at the Roswell incident. So the series became the story of this sort of traditional Philip Marlowe detective, and at the same time solving the great unsolved mysteries of the 20th century.
So this is why you have to do a whole lot of research.
Basically, what I do is I take something like the Lindbergh kidnapping or the Black Dahlia murder. I research it as if I were going to write the definitive nonfiction work on that case, and then I write a mystery story instead.
What is it about detective fiction and the whole crime genre that you respond to as a reader or a viewer?
Well, I really love the poetry of the language of somebody like Raymond Chandler. It may sound absurd to say so, but Mickey Spillane attracts me the same way. His work is like a fever dream on paper. The very low-key, clipped, understated style of Hammett, I guess it's really the literary, it's crazy to say this, but the literary aspect of it has attracted me. You add that into the idea that these writers are dealing with life and death subjects, and I do like melodrama. I do like larger than life. There's something operatic about James M. Cain, for example, or Jim Thompson, and I find that extremely appealing.
Max Allen Collins wrote the graphic novel Road to Perdition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Medicine Wheel Garden, creating sacred space for healing, celebration, and tranquility by E. Barry Kavan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Sam Mendes, director of the films Road to Perdition and American Beauty. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how we've come to overuse the word legend in describing important people. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Sam Mendes directed the new film Road to Perdition. He won an Oscar for directing his first film, American Beauty. Mendes is British. American audiences were introduced to him when he directed the Broadway revival of Cabaret, starring Alan Cumming. Mendes still works in theater. He founded London's Donmar Warehouse Theater and is currently rehearsing their productions of Twelfth Night and Uncle Vanya. Let's start with a scene from Road to Perdition. Paul Newman plays an Irish mob chief. Tom Hanks plays his hitman. Hanks' son Michael has witnessed a mob murder, and Hanks is worried about him. Here's Hanks and Newman.
How is Michael? Is he okay?
I've spoken to him. He understands.
That's tough. Seeing that for the first time. Well, you turned out. You can't protect them forever. If it wasn't this, it'd be something else. Natural law. Sons are put on this earth to trouble their fathers.
Director Sam Mendes recorded an interview with us from his London office. I asked how he persuaded Paul Newman to be in the film.
I was very aware that here's Paul Newman. He has nothing to prove anymore. Everyone knows him to be a great actor, an iconic figure, you know, a national treasure in many ways because of what he's done outside of his acting work, let alone his set of performances, you know. I spent most of my time working out who was going to do the part when Paul said no, to be honest with you, because I thought he's never going to say yes to this. You know, it's a supporting role, and, you know, the last three movies he's done, Twilight, Nobody's Fool, these are movies he's still playing the lead, you know. Why is he going to want to get out of bed to play a supporting part? But he loved the, as he put it, the personnel involved. And over a course of three meetings in his apartment, you know, we just talked about it. We talked about every aspect of the character, every aspect of the scene. We talked about very, very detailed things. Every line was analysed and scrutinised and questioned. And by the time we'd reached the end of that third meeting, we had a relationship, and he felt he was able to trust me, and obviously I felt that he trusted me, and therefore, you know, I felt thrilled and relaxed when he turned up to the first day of rehearsals, and obviously when he agreed to do the movie, and then when he turned up to the first day of rehearsals, the relationship already existed. And so, but I think one of the great talents of people like Tom Hanks and Paul Newman is to sort of diffuse any sense that they are stars. They simply want to work, and they want to discuss what they're doing, and they want to have someone who they trust to tell them whether what they're doing is working or not, and whether what they want to convey is being conveyed. And so you become very quickly a partner rather than somebody who's there to either instruct them or to just sort of say yes and no the whole time. You become a collaborator. And I suppose the two of them, you know, who'd never met before until the first day of rehearsals and never worked together, found kindred spirits in each other. And I thought that was really, I was honoured to be the person to bring them together, you know, and I feel that they work brilliantly together in the movie.
In casting Tom Hanks, did you intentionally go after someone who usually plays more heroic or at least likable characters, you know, kind of more wholesome, likable characters? To cast him for the role of the gangster killer in the movie?
I didn't. I simply go after the best actor, you know? I mean, I felt this with Kevin Spacey in American Beauty. I just went to the person that I first thought of when I read the script. And I didn't go for a conventional heroic figure, someone who's done this part before, but then I never thought that's what the role was. This man is getting a little long in the tooth to be doing what he's doing. He has a family. He regrets in many ways the life he leads, but he never talks about it. He carries that weight of guilt around with him all the time. He's a very inarticulate man. He's a very private man. And I think all of those things made me think of Tom. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to do something very interesting. I knew, of course, he hadn't been asked to do parts like this before, but I also, like anyone who's watched his career over the last 10 years, remember performances which are very dark that he's done, sections of Private Ryan, many parts, the rage and anger you see in him in Philadelphia, the fury that is in Punchline, all of those things. You know, I've seen it, and, You know, they say there's one thing better than having a great actor, and that's having a great actor who's hungry to do something he's never done before. And I was very taken with the Los Angeles Times Review, from Kenneth Turan, which described, which paralleled his career choice at this point to Jimmy Stewart's when he started doing movies like Winchester 73, you know, and taking a risk. I think ultimately also I responded to the fact that it is in his gut. I could feel that he knew he could do it. I didn't have to persuade him. He knew deep down that he understood the man. And I think that there's no substitute for that kind of confidence.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Mendes. He directed the new movie Road to Perdition, and he directed American Beauty. I want to play a scene from American Beauty. And this is a scene from early in the movie where Kevin Spacey and Annette Bening, as a husband and wife, are sitting around the dining room table, and their teenage daughter is at the table with them. Bally High is playing in the background. This is a very dysfunctional family. Kevin Spacey is very unhappy. Here's the scene.
Mom, do we always have to listen to this elevator music?
No, we don't. And as soon as you've prepared a nutritious yet savory meal that I'm about to eat, you can listen to whatever you like.
So, Janie, how was school?
It was okay.
Just okay?
No, Dad. It was spectacular.
Well, you want to know how things went at my job today? They've hired this efficiency expert, this really friendly guy named Brad. How perfect is that? And he's basically there to make it seem like they're justified in firing somebody because they couldn't just come right out and say that, could they? No, that would just be too honest. And so they've asked us, you couldn't possibly care less, could you?
Well, what do you expect? You can't all of a sudden be my best friend just because you had a bad day. I mean, hello. Barely even spoken to me for months.
Sam Mendes, I think it was really an act of genius to get Kevin Spacey in that role. And, you know, Kevin Spacey is an actor with so much screen presence. I think it's really interesting to cast someone with that amount of screen presence in the role of someone who is very alienated, very repressed, someone who sees themselves as being nearly invisible. Mm.
Yes, I mean, it's the same principle as casting Tom Hanks for different reasons here, which is that, you're asking a great actor to do something he's never done before, and you're working and rehearsing with them very hard to try and achieve that, and you're working on it every day. But in a strange way, there are parallels between the two. They're both Tom Hanks and Kevin Spacey, for the first half of both of those movies, are working against their natural screen instincts, their natural screen presence. They're fighting the relationship they already have with the audience, and they're asking you to forget the Kevin Spacey that you know, forget the Tom Hanks you know, and believe in this man, this different man, this morally ambivalent central figure, who certainly at the beginning of both movies, for different reasons, are very distant from the audience. One of them because he's frankly a sad and lost figure, and that's Kevin, and one because he's cut himself off from everybody because he's terrified of his children and his wife finding out or too much about what he does. And it's interesting. I mean, I found myself holding back the moment that, as it were, Kevin Spacey became Kevin Spacey and Tom Hanks became Tom Hanks. You know, the movie had to humanize Tom Hanks and in a sense allow Kevin to be the ironic, sharp-tongued, witty bravura performer that he is, and so there are similarities.
Now, I read in an article that Alan Ball, the screenwriter, read the screenplay out loud to you before you shot it, and I imagine you cast it as well. When I interviewed Alan Ball, I thought that his voice sounded very similar to Kevin Spacey's voice, and I'm wondering if that connected to you and if it perhaps even helped you imagine Kevin Spacey in that role early on.
Well, I'd already cast Kevin at that stage. But Alan, the droll, laconic, the droll, laconic nature of Alan and the sense in which he's an observer in his own life on some level, I think that was very helpful. But just to know Alan as a friend and to understand his sense of humor and to understand his humanity, and that alone, that's a big key, you know. And so I wanted to know Alan, because Alan wrote this amazing script, and you know, I was fortunate enough to be given it. So that was the main thing. But if you got Alan to, for example, do Angela from the movie, like you know Mina Suvari's character, you'd find that he was a pretty good Angela as well. Not to mention all the other characters. He's just, you know, he acted in his youth, and frankly, you know, he understood the spirit of those people. But I often get writers to read their own work because they hear the voices in their heads, particularly with an original screenplay or an original play. You know, there's nobody better.
My guest is Sam Mendes, director of the new film Road to Perdition and the Oscar-winning film American Beauty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Sam Mendes is my guest. He directed the new film Road to Perdition. He also directed American Beauty. American Beauty was your first movie. You've spent most of your career, I mean all of your career, including now, directing theater.
Mm-hmm.
Actors really have to make an adjustment from the stage to screen. You're talking in a much bigger way. You're projecting more when you're in a theater. And things can be much smaller, more naturalistic on screen. What are some of the differences for you as a director, directing speech on stage and speech for movies?
Well, in theater, rehearsals are everything. I mean, you know, you rehearse for weeks, and by the time you leave the rehearsal room, you've basically done the production, you know. But obviously, you're going to have to add the set and the lighting and what have you. But ultimately, where people are standing, how they're relating to each other, how they're talking to each other, their reading of their roles, whatever you want to call it, those are all already decided. Rehearsals in film are not about that at all. I don't, on the whole, get actors on their feet in rehearsals for movies. I stay around the table. It's about filling up the actor's gas tank with information, backstory, things that make them excited to do the scene, in a way. And part of that is because you don't want an actor fully exploring a scene and kind of exploding into it weeks and weeks before you're actually shooting it, because sometimes it's going to be 3 months from the rehearsals to the actual doing of the scene. Because what you don't want on the day is an actor trying to remember what he or she did with the scene. What you want is someone who's completely in the moment and feels utterly confident, and there are no barriers to her or he being as imaginative and as creative as possible. I mean, I stress here that directors feed off the energy of their actors as I have fed off the energy of cinematographers and editors and composers. I mean, you do. You're feeding off other people's creativity in addition to your own, and sometimes theirs is far greater. And it's often the case in rehearsals that someone comes up with an idea that's infinitely better than yours, and you know, you have to, like a magpie, learn to snatch that say, "Oh, that's much better," and let's run with that idea. Now let's explore that. You know, and it's more often the case that that happens in rehearsals in both movies and plays.
Once you're shooting a film scene, do you think of that scene as almost being like directing a play?
No, because what you're doing with a play is you are trying to create a performance that stands that stands the test of time, that can be recreated. So you're encouraging an actor to use their outside eye to analyze and recollect what they're doing, use their sense memory to repeat themselves loosely. I mean, they can change every night, but basically repeat themselves for weeks. With a movie, you can trick someone into giving a performance. You can throw a glass of, I mean, not that I would do this, but you can throw a glass of water in their face before the camera rolls if you want to get them to look shocked. You know, there are any number of ways to do it. You can trick performances into being, but also you're asking people to lose their outside eye, to lose their self-consciousness, to forget what they're doing, to not think too hard about it, to act totally on instinct. So it's not like directing a scene on stage at all. Actually, the rehearsing of scenes and the filming of scenes, the filming is the more relaxed in some ways, because you're not trying to fix something that has to remain. And the other thing is, you're not trying to balance eight... In a play like Uncle Vanya, which I'm directing at the moment, you're balancing eight performances simultaneously. Everyone has to be alive at the same time, and everyone has to interact. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. Whereas you only have to concentrate on one person at a time, basically, on film, unless you're directing an ensemble piece and you're in wide shot the whole time. So it's very different.
So it sounds like your psychology as a director is really different when you're working with actors on stage versus screen.
Yes, although there is something that is a fundamental similarity, which is that every actor has a different way of working and every actor needs something different from a director. Some people need immediate guidance and immediate setting of activity, and some people don't want anything set until they've fully explored the role in their own way. Similarly on film, some people don't want you to give them notes until the third or fourth take so that they just get into the swing of it. They have a chance to try a couple of things out before you start talking to them. Some people won't even do a take until you've had a discussion with them exactly what it is that you want. For example, Paul Newman wanted to know what I wanted before he did his first take. Whereas Tom Hanks was quite happy and in fact would like to just do two or three just to get into the swing of things, you know, just to loosen up. And then I would start coming in with, well, let's try this, let's try that, you know. So it's different. The psychology is responsive to the personalities that you have on your set with you. And I don't have a methodology, and I think you have a methodology at your peril, because your job is not to impose but to draw out. You know, and the moment you start imposing, you start limiting people.
Americans first became aware of you through the Broadway production of Cabaret. You had staged it in London before bringing it to Broadway. Can you talk a little bit about the process of rethinking the musical?
Yes, I did it first in my theatre, the Donmar, in London, in a very, very bare bones production, very unencumbered by the need for a set. And as is so often the case when you start with just a piece and actors and no set and no dominating design, you unlock things in the piece that you didn't really know were there. I had one overall visual concept, and that was that we were going to set the whole show within the club, and we were going to turn my theatre into a club and put people at tables and chairs, not for any particularly novelty reasons, but because I felt that the show was about the way that Germany at that period, Berlin particularly during the late 20s and early 30s, gradually began to entrap people, to seduce them and then to turn on them, and in a way I made the club, tried to make the club, a metaphor for Germany at the time. It's a place like the club that is deeply enticing, that in which all sexualities are welcomed, which is very creative, which is very free, mischievous, embracing of everything. And yet 5 years later, after the Weimar Republic had finished and as the Nazis came to power, was the most literally and metaphorically fascistic environment of the 20th century, even in history, the most classically oriented, the most brutal, etc. And how those two things happen, you know. And here was this club that in the first act was Germany in 1929 and the second act was Germany in 1939, and the place became a country. And so to a degree, when you got to the second act, you wanted to make the audience feel like the doors of the club were being locked, and what had been this place of embraced in a hedonistic way every race, color, and creed now was somewhere that was going to destroy you if you were Jewish, gay, black, anything. You know, all of these things were in my mind when I had this idea, which was just a loose idea, but it might not have worked and it could have been terrible. I also wanted, the moment you make that decision, everyone on stage is a working member of a club. The moment you make that decision, the girls who are dancing on stage need also to play in the band, because it was a club that didn't have very much money. It was based loosely on the Brechtian clubs of the period. And also, you know, allowed for a rougher, more, less, as it were, conventional Broadway reading of the show, in which Sally Bowles was able to be a great actress who was pushing herself to be a star, a great singer, which ultimately she knew she would never become. So we were using people with unconventional musical theatre voices, miking them in unusual ways. People in the band were not professional musicians, all of those things, trying to rough it up, really. Because I think that some of these pieces, Cabaret or Sweeney Todd or Gypsy or West Side Story, these are some of the greatest pieces of theatre ever written. You know, the book the music, the lyrics, the choreography in some cases. And they should be revived regularly 10, 15 years, just as one would revive Death of a Salesman or Macbeth or, you know, Long Day's Journey Into Night. These are great pieces of theatre, and each generation needs to see them again and needs to new mint them, you know, in a way. And that's the tradition of theatre, unlike movies, which need to be new, although increasingly you get that now with movies, that tradition with movies, because people are just making sequels all the time, and that's the equivalent of doing another production of an old show, I think.
Sam Mendes directed the new film Road to Perdition and the Oscar-winning film American Beauty. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg wonders if we're too quick in describing successful people as legends. This is Fresh Air. When Ted Williams died a few weeks ago, the press was divided on how to describe him. Some stories called him a baseball hero, but more called him a baseball legend. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts about what that difference says about the way we think about achievement in the media age.
I was struck by the difference in the words that George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. used in their tributes to Ted Williams. The elder Bush called Williams a great hero, whereas his son called him a baseball legend. Of course, it's understandable that the two men would think of Williams differently. Williams was no doubt a personal hero to Bush Sr., himself a talented ball player and wartime Navy pilot. But you wouldn't expect Williams' name to have had the same resonance for his son, who was still a Texas schoolboy when Williams was finishing his career. But there's a generational difference between those words, too. In the tributes to Williams, legend outnumbered hero by better than 5-1. And in fact, when the press did call Williams a hero, the stories generally added something about his service as a Marine pilot, as if his baseball achievements didn't entirely justify the label. Of course, some of that reflects a post-9/11 self-consciousness about using the word hero at all. But legend was nudging hero aside well before then. If you look at the way the press described players like Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig between 1980 and 2000, you find that the use of hero declined by 50%, while the use of legend doubled. That isn't to say that we've entirely left off expecting sports stars to be heroic. At least we seem to hold Barry Bonds accountable for the sorts of imperfections of character that we're perfectly willing to overlook in Sean Penn or Mick Jagger. But modern fans are much too hip and too knowing to put up with a hero-worshipping panegyric of pre-war sports writers like Grantland Rice. People are much more comfortable with a flip, self-referential banter that you hear on the talk shows on ESPN and Fox Sports Network, where the operant slogan seems to be, "We are not impressed." There's a sign of that shift in the disappearance of those heroic titles that the press used to bestow on players. I'm not thinking of straightforward nicknames like Dizzy, Babe, or Yogi. There are still plenty of those around. But the modern media don't go in much for Homeric epithets like the Sultan of SWAT, the Splendid Splinter, or the Yankee Clipper. And when they do, the titles usually have a postmodern edge to them. It's hard to imagine Grantland Rice immortalizing any of the 1927 Yankees with a label like the Big Unit. For that matter, Grantland Rice would never have described any player as a legend either, if only because back when he was writing, the word could only refer to a story from popular folklore, not the person who inspired it. That new meaning of the word originated with a phrase, a legend in his own time. But it wasn't until the 1970s that people began to use legend all by itself to refer to someone whose celebrity was especially long-lived. That shift from hero to legend is the media's backhand way of celebrating themselves. The measure of your greatness now is not so much what you did as how long people kept talking about you. There can be unsung heroes, after all, but there are no unsung legends. And in fact, the modern use of legend stands the traditional meaning of the word on its head. It's striking that we don't ever use the word to refer to somebody whose fame is rooted in a genuine oral tradition. We never talk about aeronautical legend Icarus or transport legend Casey Jones. On the contrary, the people we describe as legends now are the furthest thing from legendary in the literal sense of the word. They're people who have been the focus of media attention throughout their careers, the way Williams was. It's the media's way of investing their own creations with the power of folklore. It's true that somebody like Ted Williams would still be talked about even if there'd been no newspapers, radio, or TV around to document his accomplishments, if he'd played in the early era of the game, or if he'd been born with the wrong skin color to play Major League ball, like the literally legendary greats of the Negro Leagues. But the word legend has a leveling effect. It makes no distinction between people whose deeds are inherently memorable and celebrities who are pure media creations. Nose around in the press, and you'll run into references to television legend Ed McMahon, entertainment legend Charo, modeling legend Twiggy, and pop legend Leo Sayre. It seems unfair to use the same label for Ted Williams and Leo Sayre. After all, the one had 2,654 career hits, and the other only had about two. But that semantic deflation is inevitable when we make celebrity the measure of achievement, particularly when celebrity is a commodity that's so easy to coin. In an age when everybody's famous for 15 minutes, a legend is someone who has been in the limelight for half an hour. When the Yankees finished their new spring training facility in Tampa a couple of years ago, they christened it Legends Field. If they were renaming it now, I expect they'd call it Icon Field or Avatar Alley. In fact, they have my permission to rename it Heroes Field, just as soon as somebody on their roster hits for a 400 season.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with pianist Dave McKenna's tribute to Ted Williams. This is called The Splendid Splinter.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's bassist Charlie Hayden with his Quartet West. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Hayden. Next week, he turns 65 and will celebrate with a series of performances. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.